enormous stones that looked like giant umbrellas, where, in summer, we played Parpatuni, a game of hide-and-seek. In the winter, we made snowmen until our mothers called us in for a cup of hot milky tea and cardamom. For as long as I can remember, our house has been full of people, neighbors, relatives, and friends of my father's, and a never-ending stream of cousins, male and female. They came from the mountains where my parents grew up, or they came from the next town over. Even when we moved from our tiny first house and I got my own bedroom, it was rarely my own. There always seemed to be a cousin sleeping on the floor. That's because one of the most important parts of the Pashtunwali code is hospitality. As a Pashtun, you always open your door to a visitor. My mother and the women would gather on our veranda at the back of the house and cook and laugh and talk about new clothes, jewelry, and other ladies in the neighborhood, while my father and the men would sit in the men's guest room and drank tea and talked politics. I would often wander away from the children's games, tiptoe through the women's quarters, and join the men. That, it seemed to me, was where something exciting and important was happening. I didn't know what it was exactly, and I certainly didn't understand the politics, but I felt a pull to the weighty world of the men. I would sit at my father's feet and drink in the conversation. I loved to hear the men debate politics, but mostly I loved sitting among them, hypnotized by this talk of the big world beyond our valley. Eventually, I'd leave the room and linger a while among the women. The sights and sounds in their world were different. There were gentle, confiding whispers, tinkling laughter sometimes, raucous, uproarious laughter sometimes. But most stunning of all, the women's headscarves and veils were gone. Their long, dark hair and pretty faces, made up with lipstick and henna, were lovely to see. I had seen these women nearly every day of my life observing the code of Purda, where they cover themselves in public. Some, like my mother, simply draped scarves over their faces. This is called niqab. But others wore burqas, long, flowing black robes that covered the head and face so people could not even see their eyes. Some went so far as to wear black gloves and socks so that not a bit of skin was showing. I'd seen the wives be required to walk a few paces behind their husbands. I'd seen the women be forced to lower their gaze when they encountered a man. And I'd seen the older girls, who'd been our playmates, disappear behind veils as soon as they became teenagers. But to see these women chatting casually, their faces radiant with freedom, was to see a whole new world. I was never much of a hand around the kitchen. I'll admit that I tried to get out of chopping vegetables or cleaning dishes whenever I could, so I didn't linger there long. But as I ran off, I'd always wonder how it felt to live in hiding. Living under wraps seemed so unfair and uncomfortable. From an early age, I told my parents that no matter what other girls did, I would never cover my face like that. My face was my identity. My mother, who is quite devout and traditional, was shocked. Our relatives thought I was very bold. Some said rude. But my father said I could do as I wished. Malala will live as free as a bird, he told everyone. So I would run to rejoin the children, especially when it was time for the kite-flying contests, where the boys would skillfully try to cut down their competitors' kite strings. It was an exciting game, full of unpredictable escapes and plunges. It was beautiful, and also a bit melancholy for me, to see the pretty kites sputter to the ground. Maybe it was because I could see a future that would be cut down, just like those kites, simply because I was a girl. Despite what my father said, I knew that as Safina and I got older, we'd be expected to cook and clean for our brothers. we could become doctors because female doctors were needed to care for female patients. But we couldn't be lawyers or engineers, fashion designers or artists, or anything else we dreamed of. And we wouldn't be allowed to go outside our homes without a male relative to accompany us. As I watched my brothers run up to the roof to launch their kites, I wondered how free I could ever really be. But I knew, even then, that I was the apple of my father's eye, a rare thing for a Pakistani girl. When a boy is born in Pakistan, it's cause for celebration. Guns are fired in the air, gifts are placed in the baby's cot, and the boy's name is inscribed in the family tree. But when a girl is born, no one visits the parents, and women have only sympathy for the mother. My father paid no mind to these customs. I've seen my name in bright blue ink, right there among the male names of our family tree. Mine was the first female name in 300 years. Throughout my childhood, he sang me a song about my famous Pashtun namesake. "O Malalai of my wind," he'd sing. "Rise up once more and make Pashtuns understand the song of honor. Your poetic words turn worlds around. I beg you, rise up again." When I was young, I didn't understand what any of this meant. But as I grew up, I understood that Malalai was a hero and a role model, and I wanted to learn something from her. And when I started learning to read at age 5, my father would brag to his friends. "Look at this girl," he'd say. "She is destined for the skies." I pretended to be embarrassed, but my father's words of praise have always been the most precious thing in the world to me. I was far luckier than most girls in one other way too. My father ran a school. It was a humble place with nothing more than blackboards and chalk, and it was right next to a smelly river. But to me, it was a paradise. My parents tell me that even before I could talk, I would toddle into the empty classrooms and lecture. I delivered lessons in my own baby talk. Sometimes I'd get to sit in on classes with the older children, in awe as I listened to everything they were being taught. As I grew, I longed to wear the uniforms I saw the big girls wearing when they arrived each day. Shalwar kameez, a long, deep blue tunic and loose white pants, and white headscarf. My father started the school 3 years before I was born, and he was teacher, accountant, and principal, as well as janitor, handyman, and chief mechanic. He climbed up the ladder to change the light bulbs and down the well when the pump broke. When I saw him disappear down that well, I wept, thinking he would never come back. Although I didn't understand it at the time, I know now that there was never enough money. After paying the rent and salaries, there was not much left for food, so we often had little for dinner. But the school had been my father's dream, and we were all happy to be living it. When it was finally time for me to go to classes, I was so excited I could hardly contain myself. You could say I grew up in a school. The school was my world, and my world was the school. Chapter 2. Dreams. Every spring and fall, during the holidays of Big Eid and Small Eid, my family visited one of my favorite places on earth, Shangla, the mountain village where my parents grew up. Laden with presents for our relatives, embroidered shawls, boxes of rose and pistachio sweets, and medicines they couldn't get in the village, we'd go to the Mingora bus station and see just about everybody else in town all crowded together and waiting for the flying coach. We'd stack our gifts, along with the sacks of flour and sugar, blankets and trunks that other families were taking, on top of the bus in a great towering pile. Then we all crammed inside for the 4-hour trip up winding rutted roads to the mountains. For the first quarter of the journey, the road was a series of zigs and zags that followed the Swat River on one side and hugged sheer cliffs on the other. My brothers took great pleasure in pointing out the wreckage of vehicles that had fallen into the valley below. The flying coach would climb higher and higher until the air turned cool and crisp. Eventually, we saw nothing but mountain after mountain, 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 and just a sliver of sky. Many of the people in Shangla were very poor and did not have modern facilities, such as hospitals and markets, but our family always put on a huge feast for us when we arrived. A feast that was especially welcome at small Eid, which marks the end of a month of daytime fasting for Ramadan. There were bowls of chicken and rice, spinach and lamb, big crunchy apples, pretty yellow cakes, and big kettles of sweet milky tea. Even when I was only 7 or 8, I was considered a sophisticated city girl, and sometimes my cousins teased me because I didn't like to go barefoot, and I wore clothes bought at the bazaar, not homemade like theirs. I had a city accent and spoke city slang, so they thought I was modern. If only they knew. People from real cities like Peshawar or Islamabad would have thought me very backward. When I was in the village, though, I lived the life of a country girl. In the morning, I got up when the rooster crowed or when I heard the clatter of dishes as the women downstairs made breakfast for the men. Then all the children spilled out of the houses to greet the day. We ate honey straight from the hive and green plums sprinkled with salt. None of us had any toys or books, so we played hopscotch and cricket in a gully. In the afternoon, the boys would go off fishing while we girls went down to a stream to play our favorite game, wedding. We would choose a bride and then prepare her for the ceremony. We draped her in bangles and necklaces and painted her face with makeup and her hands with henna. Once she was ready to be given to the groom, she would pretend to cry and we would stroke her hair and tell her not to worry. Sometimes we would fall down laughing. But life for the women in the mountains was not easy. There were no proper shops, no universities, no hospitals or female doctors, no clean water or electricity from the government. Many of the men had left the villages to work on road crews and in mines far, far away, sending money home when they could. Sometimes the men never made it back. The women of the village also had to hide their faces whenever they left their homes, and they could not meet or speak to men who were not their close relatives. None of them could read. Even my own mother, who'd grown up in the village, couldn't read. It is not at all uncommon for women in my country to be illiterate. But to see my mother, a proud and intelligent woman, struggle to read the prices in the bazaar was an unspoken sadness for both of us, I think. Many of the girls in the village, including most of my own cousins, didn't go to school. Some fathers don't even think of their daughters as valued members of their families because they'll be married off at a young age to live with their husband's family. "Why send a daughter to school?" the men often say. "She doesn't need an education to run a house." I would never talk back to my elders. In my culture, one must never disrespect one's elders, even if they are wrong. But when I saw how hard these women's lives were, I was confused and sad. Why were women treated so poorly in our country? I asked my father this, and he told me that life was even worse for women in Afghanistan, where a group called the Taliban had taken over the country. Schools for girls had been burned to the ground, and all women were forced to wear a severe form of burqa, a head-to-toe veil that had only a tiny fabric grill for their eyes. Women were banned from laughing out loud or wearing nail polish, and they were beaten or jailed for walking without a male family member. I shuddered when he told me such things and thanked God that I lived in Pakistan, where a girl was free to go to school. It was the first time I'd heard of the Taliban. What I didn't realize was that they weren't only in Afghanistan. There was another group in Pakistan, not far away in the tribal belt, known as the Fatah. Some of them were Pashtuns, like us, and they would soon come to cast a dark shadow over my sunny childhood. But my father told me not to worry. "I will protect your freedom, Malala," he said. "Carry on with your dreams." Chapter 3. A Magic Pencil. By the time I was 8 years old, my father had more than 800 students and 3 campuses, an elementary division and 2 high schools, one for boys and one for girls. So our family finally had enough money to buy a TV. That's when I became obsessed with owning a magic pencil. I got the idea from Shakalaka Boom Boom, the show Safina and I watched after school. It was about a boy named Sanju who could make anything real by drawing it. If he was hungry, he drew a bowl of curry and it appeared. If he was in danger, he drew a policeman. He was a little hero, always protecting people who were in danger. At night I would pray, "God, please give me Sanju's pencil. I won't tell anyone. Just leave it in my cupboard. I will use it to make everyone happy." As soon as I finished praying, I would check the drawer. But the pencil was never there. One afternoon, the boys weren't home, and my mother asked me to throw away some potato peels and eggshells. I walked to the dump, just a block or so from our house, wrinkling my nose as I got close, swatting away flies, and making sure I didn't step on anything in my nice shoes. If only I had Sanju's magic pencil, I would erase it all, the smell, the rats, the giant mountain of rotting food. As I tossed our rubbish onto the heap, I saw something move. I jumped. It was a girl, my age. Her hair was matted and her skin was covered in sores. She was sorting rubbish into piles, one for cans, one for bottles. Nearby, boys were fishing in the pile for metal, using magnets on strings. I wanted to talk to them, but I was scared. Later that day, when my father returned home, I told him about the children at the dump and dragged him to see them. He spoke gently to the children, but they ran away. I asked him why they weren't in school. He told me that these children were supporting their families, selling whatever they found for a few rupees. If they went to school, their families would go hungry. As we walked back home, I saw tears on his cheek. I believe there is something good for every evil, that every time there's a bad person, God sends a good one. So I decided it was time to talk to God about this problem. "Dear God," I wrote in a letter, "did you know there are children who are forced to work in the rubbish heap?" I stopped. Of course he knew. Then I realized that it was his will that I had seen them. He was showing me what my life might be like if I couldn't go to school. Until then, I had believed a magic pencil could change the world. Now I knew I would have to do something. I didn't know what it was, but I asked God for the strength and courage to make the world a better place. I signed my letter, rolled it up, tied it to a piece of wood, placed a dandelion on top, and floated it in a stream that flows into the Swat River. Surely God would find it there. As much as I wanted to help the children from the dump, my mother wanted to help everyone. She had started putting bread crusts in a bowl on the kitchen windowsill. Nearby was an extra pot of rice and chicken. The bread was for the birds, the food was for a poor family in our neighborhood. I asked her once why she always gave food away. "We have known what it is like to be hungry, Pisho," she said. "We must never forget to share what we have." So we shared everything we had. We even shared our home with a family of 7 who had fallen on hard times. They were supposed to pay my father rent, but more often than not, he ended up lending them money. And although my father's school wasn't really making a profit,